Hello, I'm Andrew Tuck and you're listening to The Urbanist on Monocle 24, the show all about the cities we live in. In this episode, it's our best of 2017, or at least what we could fit into half an hour. We've looked back at the past 12 months to fish out some of the most colourful reports and insightful interviews here on The Urbanist, from Seattle's waterfront to Seoul's new High Line and the debate in the US over sanctuary cities.
It's not that they shield people from deportation. What they do is that they try to divorce local law enforcement from federal immigration enforcement.
Plus chats with Yang Gale and Richard Florida too. Stay tuned as we unwrap the year that was on The Urbanist right here on Monocle 24. And to start this grand tour of the year on The Urbanist, we ask you to embrace the ugly. Back in January, Monocle's contributing editor, Jessica Bridger, told us how sometimes the things you might hate actually could be good for you. Well, urbanism-wise, that is. In this monologue, she muses if maybe we need to be a little bit more daring in our cities, willing to risk the ugly to fight against an era of urban mediocrity.
We live in an era marked by the creep of sickening urban mediocrity. Everything across the world is increasingly sanitized and into an acceptable aesthetic, an urban experience. Buildings are reasonable, inoffensive, gray and beige or glass and steel. There's usually nothing truly objectionable, and ornamentation is kept to a reasonable minimum. You can imagine millions of lives playing out in these buildings, built into the existing urban fabric in old cities, or en masse in newer ones. There's something acceptable, conservative, without risk in our new urban era. No one wants to build an eyesore, risk ridicule, or worse, lower returns on investment over a daring aesthetic. Unless we're building starchitecture, but that usually results in overblown tasteful sculptures, not truly great or horribly hideous buildings. The majority of what we build is so fully mediocre that it blends. The eye glances off of it, and we think, if we think of it at all, oh yes, another residential tower has gone up. Or, there's another office building. Is that new? Or had I simply not noticed it until now? This is same the world over, from Shanghai to Berlin, from Rio to San Francisco. Perhaps the window sizes or facades are slightly different, but it all comes from the same kit of parts. Some of this is due to standardization, the use of a small number of computer programs to design and produce construction documents. Global manufacturers are indeed global. Certain materials are cost-effective the world over for building construction. But none of this explains the proliferation of not bad, not good, inoffensive, and unoriginal. Somewhere, or everywhere, something is being stifled. And in our urban experiences, we see the same. We expect a reasonable approach, community participation, nothing too bold. But what of the unusual? We have cities made better by the odd, the eyesore, the difficult. The skywalks of Hong Kong are not pretty, but walking on them, suspended between buildings, is one of the finest urban experiences in the world. The boulevards of Paris are stunning, but their lineage is ugly, designed by housemen to control the ills and ultimately the people of the city. And their construction cleared existing neighborhoods, many of them slums. This would be a radical proposal today, but it worked. This is the opposite of outdoor mallscapes taking over city centers and high streets, laying waste to anything local, taking over in a way that the majority of people find acceptable and unobjectionable. It takes courage to build a truly ugly thing, make a big decision that might be unpopular. Because in the end, the ugly often rises from convictions about form and use, how a city should be. What we are missing now is conviction. Sometimes these things that get built are truly eyesores or horrible urban decisions. But sometimes they're simply built before we appreciate them. I think here of brutalism, of the Barbican or Boston City Hall. I ask, what's better, an eyesore that most might hate, but some could conceivably love? Or this cancerous sameness that overspreads our world? For Monocle in Berlin, I'm Jessica Bridger.
In the United States, 2017 was the year of local and municipal powers rising to the top. Since Donald Trump's inauguration in January, there were numerous occasions where they stood in defiance of the policies proposed by his administration. The very first of them was at the end of January, when Trump signed an executive order stripping federal money from sanctuary cities, sending city leaders and activists into turmoil. But that opened up a debate if there's a certain type of city we want to live in. Our New York bureau chief, Ed Stocker, spoke with Tanvi Misra, who is a staff writer for CityLab, who focuses on urbanism and inequality. She started by explaining the history of sanctuary cities in America.
The way that, you know, a lot of these cities define it is that these jurisdictions, these counties, municipalities, cities, it's not that they shield people from deportation. What they do is that they try to divorce local law enforcement from federal immigration enforcement. So what they're saying is, it's not that we're shielding these people. What we're doing is we're telling our police officers to do policing instead of doing the work of federal law enforcement officers. And the way that that manifests is the immigration enforcement arm of the government called ICE will send out these requests to local law enforcement, asking them to hold people that they suspect are eligible for deportation. And what a lot of sanctuary cities, counties will do is they'll say, we will not honor those requests unless you have a warrant or unless the person has committed really serious crimes. So there's a spectrum here. So it's not one law and not all cities do the exact same thing. But basically, in very, very simple terms, these cities, they limit their local law enforcement from cooperating with federal immigration authorities to varying degrees.
Well, that was Tanvi Misra, who's from CityLab, and she was speaking to our bureau chief in New York, Ed Stocker. In late March, we delved into the world of sensory urbanism, not only to find out how to design better for our senses, but also how to improve the way we interact and take in our cities. For hundreds of years, Seattle's waterfront has been a grimy, forbidding place. It's only a few blocks from downtown, but it's tricky for pedestrians to even get to. Industrial buildings and cruise ship terminals block views of the water, and cars fly down Alaskan Way. Our contributor, Eilish O'Neill, reported on the city's plans to change all of this and deliver a more sensory experience on the waterfront.
To get to Elliott Bay from downtown Seattle, you have to walk down a dizzyingly steep hill, slippery on Seattle's rainy days. Then you have to find a way to cross the train tracks, and perhaps you'll have to wait for a train to go by. Then you'll end up here.
We are on Seattle's North Waterfront, just at the westernmost end of the Olympic Sculpture Park, on Alaskan Way and Broad Street.
Haley McKay is a Seattle landscape architect.
Where we're sitting right now at Alaskan Broad, this is kind of a crazy traffic corner. There's nowhere to cross for pedestrians. And it's also really busy.
Just south of Alaskan and Broad.
These really huge buildings for industry or for cruise lines or just big office complex. Blocks the water view, so you have to kind of go through this sensory desert.
All this, the noise, the traffic, the sensory desert, is about to change.
When we build the waterfront, that sidewalk is opened up from 15 to 20 feet to about 35 feet, so much wider, more open, a lot more room for people to enjoy the space.
Marshall Foster is the director of Seattle's Office of the Waterfront. He works on the 31st floor of a building downtown, so he can see the waterfront he's trying to reinvent through the window.
A major new landscape called the Tideline Terraces will showcase native Puget Sound landscapes, planting, flowers, space that people want to sit and enjoy and linger.
Back at the corner of Alaskan and Broad, Haley McKay shows me a glimpse of Seattle's waterfront, as it might soon become.
Visually, in this area, there's the Olympic Sculpture Park, which is gorgeous.
The park is a grassy slope. Gravel paths zigzag between sculptures. There's a 45-foot-tall giant white head. And at the bottom of the park is a bike and pedestrian path. Then, a beach.
There's the waterfront, and then there's also you know, some of these nice shops and buildings, some of these old pier buildings.
Here, you can hear birds, water, leaves, human voices, the bell at the Olympic Sculpture Park. The new promenade and landscape will continue south from the Sculpture Park toward downtown. Street trees will deaden the sound of traffic. And as for visuals, Marshall Foster says,
some of the best views you will find, you know, the Olympics, West Seattle, everything that you see out over Elliott Bay, in a setting that you'll actually want to spend time in.
And it'll be easier to get here.
We'll build a bridge connection, a landscaped bridge, a park bridge that will connect Pike Place Market across the new road, elevated above the road so you won't have to cross the traffic, and then down to the new waterfront. That'll just really make the waterfront part of the daily life of the city.
Foster says he imagines a place where people take their lunches during the workday, where people take their kids on the weekend, and where people have a glass of wine while they watch a concert on the pier.
And that's something that Seattle already has in its DNA on our waterfront, is the importance of having music, having big events that bring the whole city together.
Foster says he took part of his playbook from New York City's Highline Park, what was once an elevated railway and is now an elevated pedestrian path lined with plants and park benches.
The Highline is a tiny little stitch through that part of Chelsea, and it just provides a counterpoint. It provides openness, it provides a gorgeous landscape set against a thriving, bustling, loud city. Those two things are in tension, but that's also really interesting. So we think that's part of what people are going to really love about this. And that's actually what brings people to these kinds of urban places.
Construction on Seattle's new promenade has already begun. And if all goes as planned, it'll be finished by 2022. For Monocle in Seattle, I'm Alicia O'Neill.
Midway through the year, we welcomed the urbanist Richard Florida into our Toronto bureau to talk about his new book, The New Urban Crisis. In it, he argues that the influx of young people back to urban centres two decades ago, celebrated at the time, has actually contributed to a simmering crisis in our cities. Here's a highlight from his conversation with Monocle's Thomas Lewis.
The comeback of the cities and the urban revival is a fantastic thing. But I think up until recently, there was an optimism that this back to the city movement would lift many boats, perhaps quite naive, that because people weren't coming back en masse. The cities were dying. There was the proverbial, what we called in the United States, the hole in the donut. I think there was this optimism. And if I look at the writing in Urban Affairs, there is a whole group of urban optimists. But then there are a lot of left-leaning urbanists who have been cautioning, the great David Harvey, saying, you know, we're seeing this gentrification. And Mike Davis, the L.A.-based writer, writing about the transformation of L.A. And in this book, it's been very hard for me. I try to reconcile these two competing schools, the urban optimists and the urban pessimists. And I actually ask a question in the book. I say something like, is it true that cities are the engines of economic growth? Is it the case that cities are the fonts of innovation? Is it the case that also cities are where tolerance and civil progress and social decency, you know, the centers of civilization? But is it also the case that cities are increasingly divided, that cities are the centers of inequality, that cities are these hyper-gentrified places? And the answer to all those questions is yes. And I think that's what this book tries to reconcile, that cities are both the source of progress and the source of division, and left to their own devices, they will not heal themselves. So the book is a call really for a new urban agenda. I think the hard part here is that it would be wonderful if we had a national urban policy, but with Trump in control of the United States and with the conservatives' control in the United Kingdom and with this populist movement, which is really an anti-urbanist, it's really give me back my country. And really what's so daunting about this is there won't be a national urban strategy. So cities and metro areas or what I call the mega regions, you know, these areas like the Boston, New York, Washington corridor, conglomerations of various cities and metros are going to have to do it on their own. And I think that's been the big wake-up call for me. The rise of populism and Trumpism mean that we're not going to have a national agenda for cities and urbanism. In a way, we're going to have to do it ourselves, which is these are big problems and they're hard problems. They're terribly difficult problems. Cities and metro areas, communities, cities and suburbs are going to have to begin to solve them on their own.
That was the urban thinker Richard Florida, and he was speaking to Monocle's Thomas Lewis. Richard's new book, The New Urban Crisis, is of course out now. We've all heard about New York's High Line and the growing trend in urban development that favours rehabilitating old infrastructure over tearing it down. Right before the summer, the South Korean capital unveiled its own version. It turned a highway overpass into an elevated pedestrian walkway and park. Our Seoul correspondent, Jason Strother, went on a tour.
All good press tours start with putting on a hard hat.
All right, perfect fit.
The dilapidated highway overpass that flanks Seoul Station is still under construction just a few days before it's set to make its re-debut to the public. It's now called Solo 7017, those numbers referring to the year that the road was open to vehicular traffic and the year that it was turned into a pathway for those who go by foot. Kim Kwan-gi oversees the near $50 million restoration project for the Seoul Metropolitan Government. He's leading this tour along the bridge, which runs about 1.7 kilometers long and at its highest point reaches 17 meters. It gives pedestrians an overview of the Seoul Station rail yard as well as one of the city's more congested intersections. Kim says this was not the original plan for the overpass.
This highway was getting really old. It was built back in 1970, and at first the plan was to demolish it. But then there was no connection between eastern and western Seoul in this area. We decided that tearing down the highway wasn't the right option, and the city decided instead to turn the structure into this walkway.
A train passes us below as we cross over the rail yard. Solo 7017 is much more than just a shortcut from one side of the tracks to the other. It's a garden way above the street level. There are hundreds of different types of potted trees and plants all along the walkway. Some of the bridge is reserved for art space and will hold cultural events, and there will be small trampolines which will give kids something to play on. But don't worry, we're ensured they won't bounce over the high guardrails. Highway overpasses like this were once seen as a mark of progress in South Korea. Back in the 1970s, the so-called Miracle on the Han era, the country emerged from poverty and big public infrastructure projects that accommodated all the people who could now afford to buy cars were seen as a symbol of economic development. Seoul became a car-friendly city. A consequence was that all these elevated roadways made the city pretty ugly and clogged with vehicles. But many of these overpasses have been torn down in recent years, and pedestrians are reclaiming the streets. Seoul's Kim Kwan-gi says renovating this overpass both preserves a part of the capital's recent history and improves the quality of life of citizens. He says Seoul is now a more human-friendly city.
I think this is making the city more beautiful. This project puts more importance on the citizens' personal mobility than a car's. It's the start of this change in focus, and we plan on making more green spaces for our residents.
The Solo 7017 has now dipped back down to street level. We are eye to eye with bus drivers and other motorists. We've given back our hard hats. The tour is over. The city expects that each year 4.4 million visitors will walk along this sky garden, which has helped make the city both more human friendly and greener.
That was our man in Seoul, Jason Strother.
Basement starts on the first floor, the ground floor.
There was rapid fire,
down the
because that's why I thought it was
fireworks. They told us that they had been instructed to shut the doors, and there was a kind of wave of panic in the basement.
And have a look through the window to see if it was fireworks.
25 minutes past midnight, the Met Police suggesting that the incident on the bridge and indeed in London, in Borough Market, they are now treating those as terrorist in nature.
In between last week's show and today's, 8 people have been murdered in London in a terrorist attack. the killers, Islamist extremists, used first a van to mow down people crossing London Bridge, and then, after crashing the vehicle, used knives and blades to slash and slaughter people out enjoying a summer's evening in Borough Market, whose restaurants and pubs are always packed on a summer's night. On The Urbanist, we get to meet lots of amazing people and go into the granular details of what makes a city tick. We get to talk about shared space, resilience, community building, and the hard-to-fathom psychology of a city that allows us all to get on despite being crammed together. And at the end of the show, I take off my headphones and usually feel rather inspired by the places we get to call home. And then this. Yes, when I look out of the window this morning from our HQ at Midori House, the trees are still rippling in the breeze. There are still people sitting on the benches smoking, reading their papers, and the weather continues to disappoint. Could the sun come out, please? But is it the same? On one side, there is defiance. People are already back drinking in the very places where others were butchered just days ago. London will not be defeated, they say. But on the other side, I sense disquiet. There are killers in our midst. This being the second murderous terror assault in 3 months in London. Back in March, another Islamist murderer killed 6 people in a similarly styled attack on Westminster Bridge. People are rightly cautious. Perhaps I'll go straight home tonight. A friend tells me how he now takes off his headphones when crossing a bridge, and he looks over his shoulder if he hears a fast-moving van. How long this will last, I don't know, but the city will change in more permanent ways. Barriers, concrete barricades, more security. And trust, oh yes, that's dented. This will not stop London, don't get me wrong. It will not stop Londoners. But for now, let us grieve and also feel aggrieved. Let us have some anger. Cities heal and regenerate, and London has pulled off this trick many, many times. But as I look at the faces of the murdered, people who came from all over the world to make this city their home, came to work, came to learn, I don't want to forget or move on just yet. Yes, it's good to be a resilient city, but sometimes it's also good to be a fucked off one too. For Monocle, I'm Andrew Tuck. This has also been a year packed with urbanism conferences, from Resite in Prague to the Resilient Cities Summit in New York and CityLab in Paris. In September, though, the urbanist team was dispatched to Aarhus, Denmark's second city, for this year's Congress of the Academy of Urbanism. And we couldn't leave without speaking with the most famous Dane in the world of city living, Jan Gehl. We caught up with him on the day of his 81st birthday to reflect on what comes next for urbanism and him.
I've worked with research and with communication and with preaching for cities for 50 years. And I really feel that after year 2000, there's been a change in the direction of the wind, that some of the old vices of the 20th century is being left behind us. All this celebration of modernism and of motorism, many more people are questioning this. And it's distinctly possible to see now that one city after the other starts on a new agenda of making it more people-friendly. Also, many of them are introducing bicycles and doing more for public transportation, and also doing various things to subdue the limitless use of motor cars. So, after 2000, I really see a change in paradigm for city planning. Also, we have, besides this about having a more livable, better quality of life, we have two other big drivers now. One is that we have to make the cities respond to the climate challenge, And we also have to respond to the sitting syndrome. We've built cities for 50 years. We've invited everybody to sit from morning till night. And now the doctors all over the world realize that that was not so smart. And now the World Health Organization are urging all the cities in the world to make sure that people walk and bike as much as possible in their daily day doings. So that's the new driver. And all of this points to the fact that if you do more of the basics, first things first, do more people-oriented planning and make sure that people can use their cities as persons, as homo sapiens, walking and bicycles, you're getting a more livable, a more sustainable, and a much more healthy population.
That was the Danish architect and urban visionary, Jan Gehl. Now, we're going to finish our tour with a story from last month when we profiled how cities deal with rubbish and waste. In the case of South Africa, informal waste pickers and recyclers take up the strain as authorities struggle to cope with all of that waste. It's estimated that 100,000 people go through other people's bins looking for things to sell or recycle. The informal sector is worth some $60 million a year just in saved landfill costs to the government. But most waste pickers work in terrible conditions for very little pay. So what can be done to help these recyclers? Monocle's contributor, Gavin Fisher, went to find out.
A rubbish dump in the south of Johannesburg. Piles of unwashed milk cartons, cans and beer bottles are being sorted. With the sun beating down and flies in the air, it is literally stinking hot. But this waste is the prize for hours of work by informal recyclers. Taken from bins across the city, piled onto trolleys and dragged here, the waste pickers will now sort and sell to recycling plants.
Somebody was buying here, and then if they finish to buy, they put their stuff in.
Sol Mashau is from the South African Waste Pickers Association. He's here to help me chat to some of the recyclers.
Sorry guys, Ozani. Ozani kancane lana.
But most aren't keen, and you can understand why. The job is technically illegal. The waste doesn't belong to them. But when one guy, called Tebo, agrees to speak, it's clear the illegality isn't one of the main issues.
To pull the trolley the whole day is not easy. When he pulls the trolley on the street, the cars are coming behind. Sometimes the cars stamped on his pig and he fell. He get injured sometimes by so doing.
In his mid-30s, thin-faced and weather-beaten, Tebo tells me he's been a recycler for 2 years. On average, he makes just 300 rand, or around $20 a week, with which he has to support his wife and kids.
This job is not an easy job. It's a very difficult job. If maybe you want to make a life, then you can't survive.
They're definitely an asset, yeah, we value them. What we don't like is the type of work they do.
Belinda Booker works for leading plastic recycling company Petco. Though the work conditions of the informal recyclers concern her, she's clear how important that work is.
Our recycling rates is just under Europe and beating America. So we're doing very well with our recycling rates. At the moment, with our targets that we meet, about 80% of them are still being collected by the informal sector. They're brilliant.
Traditionally, the waste picker's job has been seen as one of the lowest in society, though Belinda does believe that is changing.
Because they're digging in sometimes in householders' waste, a lot of people see them as a nuisance because they will dig something and they will maybe mess around the area. But a lot of householders, they tell us now, they sort of have changed their views about them because there's some more media has been happening. And a lot of householders would now put the material aside for them on the day that they actually come and pick in their bins.
Yeah, okay, let's go to those guys. Okay.
Back at the dump, it's clear the recyclers' working conditions don't match the vital nature of their work. But with youth unemployment in South Africa standing at over 50%, recyclers like Maketi, who's in his 20s, find they have no other option.
He was trying to go to school for civil engineering, but now he can't make it because there's nobody who's giving me support. He hasn't got parents. He's the only one who's trying to make life, but that is why he came to make a recycling.
Maketi has only been recycling for a few weeks, but he already looks dazed by the experience. So what can be done to improve lives like his?
We have to be very careful that we help them the way they want to be helped.
Belinda is part of a government committee tasked with legalising the recyclers' work and improving conditions. The main aim is to grant them recycling contracts, but Belinda says this is no easy thing.
The problem is, for a formal government structure to give them a tender, they have to be a body. You can't give a contract to 200 individual people. So they have to become a structure where they have to get together and form a cooperative, which they don't want to. They work by themselves, they are entrepreneurs, they work their own time at their own pace. A lot of them don't want to be formalized into cooperatives.
But there are those trying to change this attitude.
Aram.
Hello, Baba.
Hello, I'm Gavin.
On another waste site, this one in the town of Sasolburg, south of Johannesburg, I search out one of those behind a recycling cooperative that could form a model for the future.
Okay, my name is Thoriso Abram Dumailiti. I do recycling.
A humble description from a humble man. Abram and four other waste pickers have banded together, and with funding from organisations like Petco, have formed a formal recycling collection scheme.
It's part of separation at source to encourage people not to mix wet waste and recyclables. Most of the residents, now they don't mix their recyclables and wet waste.
The cooperative allows them to provide a reliable pickup service and a more steady income for themselves.
Working as a group is a good thing because if you are sick, you can get something while you are at home recovering from your sickness. If you are working as a cooperative, we look out for each other. So that is one thing that I like about cooperative.
The cooperative system has also allowed them to access new equipment. They won local government enterprise funding to buy a new waste collection vehicle, moving them away from collection by trolley.
When we started here, we used to collect with those trolleys. Yeah, it's so much better rather than pushing a trolley.
Such vehicles are being provided in a number of projects in South Africa, seen as one way of formalising recycling and making it safer. But as Abram explains, there are other fundamental issues still to be solved.
The pricing of the material, the people who buy things from us, they are not trustworthy. They don't tell you when the prices go down.
These prices mean Abram is only earning around 500 rand a week, not much more than those pulling a trolley. The work is safer, cleaner and more reliable, but Abram says such low rates give the cooperatives little more appeal than working as an individual. But the cooperative has a plan to change this.
When we want to sell to the big market, they require tons. So our aim is to bargain our materials with other cooperatives and then so that we can sell to the big market. So we have engaged with other recyclers at the local areas. Now we have registered 7 cooperatives. So I know if I've donated 5 ton and the other guy donated 8 ton and the other guy donated 3 ton, and then we can always share the money.
It does seem attitudes are changing. The public is more willing to work with recyclers, and projects like this show some waste pickers are more open to working together. These changes can only be good for recycling rates, for the government's landfill bill, and for the environment. But until more support is provided to the system, the ones doing the real work will continue to do little more than survive. For Monocle in Sasolburg, South Africa, I'm Gavin Fisher.
Well, that's all for this week's episode of The Urbanist. Join us next week as we recap the best of our tool stories. Thank you for joining us through 2017. And we hope you will keep us company through 2018 too. Today's show was produced by Carlotta Ribello and it was edited by David Stevens. To play you out of this episode of The Urbanist, it's Starship with We Built This City. Have a happy new year and thank you for listening, City Lovers.